turning a pug mill, circling endlessly, the wooden mill shaft creaking in its blocks. Chickens and smaller birds were scratching at the base of the mill. The pole was a good 4 feet off the ground, yet the birds ducked or squatted each time it passed overhead. In the dust of the plaza lay a number of men, apparently asleep. White, Indian, Mexican. Some covered with blankets, and some not. At the far end of the square, there was a public whipping post that was dark about its base, where dogs had pissed on it. The lieutenant followed their gaze. Glanton pushed back his hat and looked down from his horse. "Where in this puke hole can a man get a drink?" he said. It was the first word any of them had spoken. Couch looked them over, haggard and haunted and blacked by the sun. The lines and pores of their skin deeply grimed with gunblack where they'd washed the bores of their weapons. Even the horses looked alien to any he'd ever seen, decked as they were in human hair and teeth and skin. Save for their guns and buckles and a few pieces of metal in the harness of the animals, there was nothing about these arrivals to suggest even the discovery of the wheel.
"There are several places," said the lieutenant. "None open yet, though, I'm afraid." "They're fixing to get that way," said Glanton.
He nudged the horse forward. He didn't speak again, and none of the others had spoken at all. As they crossed the plaza, a few vagrants raised their heads up out of their blankets and looked after them. The bar they entered was a square mud room, and the proprietor set about serving them in his underwear. They sat on a bench at a wooden table in the gloom, drinking sullenly.
"Where you all from?" said the proprietor.
Glanton and the judge went out to see if they could recruit any men from the rabble reposing in the dust of the square. Some of them were sitting squinting in the sun. A man with a bowie knife was offering to cut blades with anyone at a wager to see who had the better steel. The judge went among them with his smile.
"Ken, what all you got in them saddle grips?"
Glanton turned. He and the judge carried their valises across their shoulders. The man who'd spoken was propped against a post with one knee drawn up to support his elbow.
"These bags?" said Glanton. "Them bags." "These here bags are full of gold and silver," said Glanton, for they were.
The idler grinned and spat.
"That's why he's wanting to go to California," said another. "Account of he's done got a satchel full of gold now."
The judge smiled benignly at the wastrels.
"You're liable to take a chill out here," he said. "Who's for the gold fields now?"
One man rose and took a few steps away and began to piss in the street.
"Maybe the wild man'll go with you," called another. "Him and Cloyce'll make you good hands. They've been trying to go for long enough."
Glanton and the judge sought them out. A rude tent thrown up out of an old tarp, a sign that said, "See the wild man, 2 bits. They passed behind a wagon sheet where within a crude cage of Palo Verde poles crouched a naked imbecile. The floor of the cage was littered with filth and trodden food, and flies clambered about everywhere. The idiot was small and misshapen, and his face was smeared with feces, and he sat peering at them with dull hostility, silently chewing a turd. The owner came from the rear, shaking his head at them.
"There ain't nobody allowed in here. We ain't open."
Glanton looked about the wretched enclosure. The tent smelled of oil and smoke and excrement. The judge squatted to study the imbecile.
"Is that thing yours?" Glanton said. "Yes, yes, he is."
Glanton spat.
"Man told us you was wanting to go to California." "Well," said the owner, "yes, that's right. That is right. What do you figure to do with that thing?" "Take him with me." "How you aim to haul him?" "Got a pony and cart to haul him in." "You got any money?"
The judge raised up.
"This is Captain Glanton," he said. He's leading an expedition to California. He's willing to take a few passengers under the protection of his company, provided they can find themselves adequately. Well, now, yes. Got some money? How much money are we talking about? How much have you got? Said Glanton. Well, adequate, I'd say. I'd say adequate in money. Glanton studied the man. I'll tell you what I'll do with you, he said. Are you wanting to go to California, or are you just mouth? California, said the owner. By all means. I'll carry you for $100, paid in advance. The man's eyes shifted from Glanton to the judge and back. I like some of having that much, he said. We'll be here a couple of days, said Glanton. You find us some more fares, and we'll adjust your tariff accordingly. The captain will treat you right, said the judge. You can be assured of that. Yes, sir, said the owner. As they passed out by the cage, Glanton turned to look at the idiot again. You let women see that thing? He said. I don't know, said the owner. There's none ever asked. By noon, the company had moved on to an eating house. There were three or four men inside when they entered, and they got up and left. There was a mud oven in the lot behind the building, and the bed of a wrecked wagon with a few pots and a kettle on it. An old woman in a gray shawl was cutting up beef ribs with an axe while two dogs sat watching. A tall, thin man in a blood-stained apron entered the room from the rear and looked them over. He leaned and placed both hands on the table before them. Gentlemen, he said, we don't mind serving people of color. Glad to do it. But we asked for him to sit over here at this other table there, right over here. He stepped back and held out one hand in a strange gesture of hospice. His guests looked at one another. What in the hell is he talking about? Just right over here, said the man. Toadvine looked down the table to where Jackson sat. Several looked toward Glanton. His hands were at rest on the board in front of him, and his head was slightly bent like a man at grace. The judge sat smiling, his arms crossed. They were all slightly drunk. He thinks we're niggers. They sat in silence. The old woman in the court had commenced wailing some dolorous air, and the man was standing with his hand outheld. Piled just within the door were the satchels and holsters and arms of the company. Glanton raised his head. He looked at the man. What's your name? He said.
Name's Owens. I own this place.
Mr. Owens, if you was anything at all other than a goddamn fool, you could take one look at these here men and know for a stone fact there ain't a one of them gonna get up from where they're at to go set somewhere else.
Well, I can't serve you.
Well, you suit yourself about that. Ask her what she's got, Tommy.
Harlan was sitting at the end of the table, and he leaned out and called to the old woman at her pots and asked her in Spanish what she had to eat. She looked toward the house.
Huesos,
she said.
Huesos, said Harlan. Tell her to bring them, Tommy.
She won't bring you nothing without I tell her to. I own this place.
Harlan was calling out the open door.
I know for a fact that man yonder's a nigger, said Owens.
Jackson looked up at him. Brown turned toward the owner.
Have you got a gun?
He said.
A gun?
A gun. Have you got a gun?
Not on me, I ain't.
Brown pulled a small 5-shot Colt from his belt and pitched it to him. He caught it and stood holding it uncertainly.
You got one now. Now shoot the nigger.
Wait a goddamn minute, said Owens.
Shoot him, said Brown.
Jackson had risen, and he pulled one of the big pistols from his belt.
Owens pointed the pistol at him. You put that down, he said. You better forget about giving orders and shoot the son of a bitch. Put it down, goddamn man. Tell him to put it down.
Shoot him.
He cocked the pistol. Jackson fired. He simply passed his left hand over the top of the revolver he was holding in a gesture brief as flint spark and tripped the hammer. The big pistol jumped, and a double handful of Owens's brains went out the back of his skull and plopped in the floor behind him. He sank without a sound and lay crumpled up with his face in the floor and one eye open and the blood welling up out of the destruction at the back of his head. Jackson sat down. Brown rose and retrieved his pistol and let the hammer back down and put it in his belt.
"Most terrible nigger I ever seen," he said. "Find some plates, Charlie. I doubt the old lady's out there anymore."
They were drinking in a cantina not 100 feet from this scene when the lieutenant and a half-dozen armed troopers entered the premises. The cantina was a single room, and there was a hole in the ceiling where a chunk of sunlight fell through onto the mud floor, and figures crossing the room steered with care past the edge of this column of light, as if it might be hot to the touch. They were a hard-bit denizenry, and they shambled to the bar and back in their rags and skins like cave folk exchanging at some nameless trade. The lieutenant circled this reeking solarium and stood before Glanton.
"Captain, we're going to have to take whoever's responsible for the death of Mr. Owens into custody."
Glanton looked up.
"Who's Mr. Owens?" he said. "Mr. Owens is the gentleman who ran the eating house down here. He's been shot to death." "Sorry to hear it," said Glanton. "Sit down."
Couch ignored the invitation.
"Captain, you don't aim to deny that one of your men shot him, do you?" "I aim exactly that," said Glanton. "Captain, it won't hold water."
The judge emerged from the darkness.
"Evening, Lieutenant," he said. "Are these men the witnesses?"
Couch looked at his corporal.
"No," he said, "they ain't witnesses." "Hell, Captain, you all was seen to enter the premises and seen to leave after the shot was fired. Are you going to deny that you and your men took your dinner there?"
"Deny every goddamn word of it," said Glanton.
"Well, by God, I believe I can prove that you ate there."
"Kindly address your remarks to me, Lieutenant," said the judge. "I represent Captain Glanton in all legal matters. I think you should know, first of all, that the captain does not propose to be called a liar, and I would think twice before I involve myself with him in an affair of honor. Secondly, I have been with him all day, and I can assure you that neither he nor any of his men have ever set foot in the premises to which you allude."
The lieutenant seemed stunned at the baldness of these disclaimers. He looked from the judge to Glanton and back again.
"I will be damned," he said.
And then he turned and pushed past the men and quit the place. Glanton tilted his chair and leaned his back to the wall. They had recruited 2 men from among the town's indigents, an unpromising pair that sat gawking at the end of the bench with their hats in their hands. Glanton's dark eye passed over them and alighted on the owner of the imbecile, who sat alone across the room watching him.
"You a drinking man?" said Glanton.
"How's that?"
Glanton exhaled slowly through his nose.
"Yes," said the owner. "Yes, I am."
There was a common wooden pail on the table before Glanton with a tin dipper in it, and it was about a third full of wagon yard whiskey drawn off from a cask at the bar. Glanton nodded toward it.
"I ain't carrying it to you."
The owner rose and picked up his cup and came across to the table. He took up the dipper and poured his cup and set the dipper back in the bucket. He gestured slightly with the cup and raised and drained it.
"Much obliged.
Where's your ape at?"
The man looked at the judge. He looked at Glanton again.
"I don't take him out much."
"Where'd you get that thing at?"
"He was left to me. Mama died. There was nobody to take him to raise. They shipped him to me, Joplin, Missouri. Just put him in a box and shipped him. Took 5 weeks. Didn't bother him a bit.
I opened up the box, and there he sat.
Get you another drink there.
He took up the dipper and filled his cup again.
Big as life. Never hurt him a bit. I had him a hair suit made, but he ate it.
Ain't everybody in this town seen the son of a bitch?
Yes, yes they have. I need to get to California. I may charge 4 bits out there.
You may get tarred and feathered out there.
I've been that. State of Arkansas. Claimed I'd given him something, drugged him. They took him off and waited for him to get better, but of course he didn't do it. They had a special preacher come and pray over him. Finally, I got him back. I could have been somebody in this world wasn't for him.
Do I understand you correctly, said the judge, that the imbecile is your brother?
Yes, sir, said the man. That's the truth of the matter.
The judge reached and took hold of the man's head in his hands and began to explore its contours. The man's eyes darted about, and he held on to the judge's wrists. The judge had his entire head in his grip like an immense and dangerous faith healer. The man was standing tiptoe, as if to better accommodate him in his investigations. And when the judge let go of him, he took a step back and looked at Glanton with eyes that were white in the gloom. The recruits at the end of the bench sat watching with their jaws down, and the judge narrowed an eye at the man and studied him, and then reached and gripped him again, holding him by the forehead while he prodded along the back of his skull with the ball of his thumb. When the judge put him down, the man stepped back and fell over the bench, and the recruits commenced to bob up and down and to wheeze and croak. The owner of the idiot looked about the tawdry grog shop, passing up each face as if it did not quite suffice. He picked himself up and moved past the end of the bench. When he was halfway across the room, the judge called out to him.
"Has he always been like that?" said the judge.
"Yes, sir. He was born that way."
He turned to go. Glanton emptied his cup and set it before him and looked up.
"Were you?"
he said. But the owner pushed open the door and vanished in the blinding light without. The lieutenant came again in the evening. He and the judge sat together, and the judge went over points of law with him. The lieutenant nodded, his lips pursed. The judge translated for him Latin terms of jurisprudence. He cited cases, civil and martial. He quoted Coke and Blackstone, Anaximander, Thales. In the morning, there was new trouble. A young Mexican girl had been abducted. Parts of her clothes were found torn and bloodied under the north wall, over which she could only have been thrown. In the desert were drag marks, a shoe. The father of the child knelt clutching a blood-stained rag to his chest, and none could persuade him to rise, and none to leave. That night fires were lit in the streets, and a beef killed. And Glanton and his men were host to a motley collection of citizens and soldiers and reduced Indians, or Tontos, as their brothers outside the gates would name them. A keg of whiskey was broached, and soon men were reeling aimlessly through the smoke. A merchant of that town brought forth a litter of dogs, one of whom had 6 legs, and another 2, and a third with 4 eyes in its head. He offered these for sale to Glanton, and Glanton warned the man away and threatened to shoot them. The beef was stripped to the bones, and the bones themselves carried off, and vigas were dragged from the ruined buildings and piled onto the blaze. By now many of Glanton's men were naked and lurching about, and the judge soon had them dancing while he fiddled on a crude instrument he'd commandeered. And the filthy hides of which they divested themselves smoked and stank and blackened in the flames, and the red sparks rose like the souls of the small life they'd harbored. By midnight, the citizens had cleared out, and there were armed and naked men pounding on doors demanding drink and women.
in the early morning hours when the fires had burned to heaps of coals and a few sparks scampered in the wind down the cold clay streets, feral dogs trotted around the cook fire, snatching out the blackened scraps of meat, and men lay huddled naked in the doorways, clutching their elbows and snoring in the cold. By noon they were abroad again, wandering red-eyed in the streets, fitted out for the most part in new shirts and breeches. They collected the remaining horses from the farrier, and he stood them to a drink. He was a small, sturdy man named Pacheco, and he had for anvil an enormous iron meteorite, shaped like a great molar. And the judge on a wager lifted the thing, and on a further wager lifted it over his head. Several men pushed forward to feel the iron and to rock it where it stood. Nor did the judge lose this opportunity to ventilate himself upon the ferric nature of heavenly bodies and their powers and claims. Two lines were drawn in the dirt 10 feet apart, and a third round of wagers was laid. Coins from half a dozen countries in both gold and silver, and even a few boletas or notes of discounted script from the mines near Tubac. The judge sees that great slag wandered for what millennia from what unreckonable corner of the universe, and he raised it overhead and stood tottering and then lunged forward. It cleared the mark by a foot, and he shared with no one the specie piled on the saddle blanket at the farrier's feet, for not even Glanton had been willing to underwrite this third trial. Chapter 17. Leaving Tucson. A new cooperage. An exchange. Saguaro Forests. Glanton at the fire. Garcia's command. The Parasolini. The Godfire. The ex-priest on astronomy. The judge on the extraterrestrial. On order. On teleology in the universe. A coin trick. Glanton's dog, dead animals, the sands, a crucifixion, the judge on war, the priest does not say, tierras quebradas, tierras desamparadas, the Tinajas Atlas, un hueso de piedra, the Colorado, Argonauts, Yumas, the ferryman, to the Yuma camp. They rode out at dusk. The corporal at the gatehouse above the portal came out and called to them to halt, but they didn't. They rode 21 men and a dog and a little flatbed cart aboard which the idiot and his cage had been lashed as if for a sea journey. Lashed on behind the cage rode the whiskey keg they'd drained the night before. The keg had been dismantled and rebound by a man Glanton had appointed Cooper pro tem to the expedition, and it now contained within it a flask made from a common sheep's stomach and holding perhaps 3 quarts of whiskey. This flask was fitted to the bung at the inside, and the rest of the keg was filled with water. So provisioned, they passed out through the gates and beyond the walls onto the prairie where it lay pulsing in the banded twilight. The little cart jostled and creaked, and the idiot clutched at the bars of his cage and croaked hoarsely after the sun. Glanton rode at the fore of the column in a new ringgold saddle, ironbound, that he'd traded for, and he wore a new hat which was black and became him. The recruits, now 5 in number, grinned at one another and looked back at the sentry. David Brown rode at the rear, and he was leaving his brother here for what would prove forever. And his mood was foul enough for him to have shot the sentry with no provocation at all. When the sentry called again, he swung about with his rifle, and the man had the sense to duck under the parapet, and they heard no more from him. In the long dusk, the savages rode out to meet them, and the whiskey was exchanged for upon a saltillo blanket spread on the ground. Glanton paid little attention to the proceedings. When the savages had counted out gold and silver to the judge's satisfaction, Glanton stepped onto the blanket and kicked the coins together with his boot heel, and then stepped away and directed Brown to take up the blanket. Mangus and his lieutenants exchanged dark looks, but the Americans mounted up and rode out, and none looked back save the recruits. They'd become privy to the details of the business, and one of them fell in alongside Brown and asked if the Apaches would not follow them.
"They won't ride at night," said Brown.
The recruit looked back at the figures gathered about the keg in that scoured and darkening waste.
"Why won't they?" he said.
Brown spat.
"Because it's dark," he said.
They rode west from the town, across the base of a small mountain, through a dog town strewn with old broken earthenware from a crockery furnace that once had been there. The keeper of the idiot rode downside of the trestled cage, and the idiot clutched the poles and watched the land pass in silence. They rode that night through forests of saguaro up into the hills to the west. The sky was all overcast, and those fluted columns passing in the dark were like the ruins of vast temples, ordered and grave and silent, save for the soft cries of elf owls among them. The terrain was thick with chola, and clumps of it clung to the horses with spikes that would drive through a boot sole to the bones within. And a wind came up through the hills, and all night it sang with a wild viper sound through that countless reach of spines. They rode on, and the land grew more spare, and they reached the first of a series of jornadas, where there would be no water at all, and there they camped. That night Glanton stared long into the embers of the fire. All about him his men were sleeping, but much was changed. So many gone, defected, or dead. The Delawares all slain. He watched the fire, and if he saw portents there, it was much the same to him. He would live to look upon the western sea, and he was equal to whatever might follow, for he was complete at every hour. Whether his history should run concomitant with men and nations, whether it should cease. He'd long forsworn all weighing of consequence, and allowing as he did that men's destinies are given, yet he usurped to contain within him all that he would ever be in the world, and all that the world would be to him. And be his charter written in the Orstone itself, he claimed agency, and said so, and he'd drive the remorseless sun on to its final endarkment, as if he'd ordered it all ages since, before there were paths anywhere, before there were men or sons to go upon them. Across from him sat the vast abhorrence of the judge, half naked, scribbling in his ledger. In the thorn forest through which they'd passed, the little desert wolves yapped, and on the dry plain before them others answered, and the wind fanned the coals that he watched. The bones of Chola that glowed there in their incandescent basketry pulsed like burning holothurians in the phosphorus dark of the sea's deeps. The idiot in his cage had been drawn close to the fire, and he watched it tirelessly. When Glanton raised his head, he saw the kid across the fire from him, squatting in his blanket, watching the judge. 2 days later, they encountered a ragged legion under the command of Colonel Garcia. They were troops from Sonora seeking a band of Apaches under Pablo, and they numbered close to 100 riders. Of these, some were without hats, and some without pantaloons, and some were naked under their coats, and they were armed with derelict weapons, old fusils, and tower muskets. Some with bows and arrows, or nothing more than ropes with which to garrote the enemy. Glanton and his men reviewed this company with stony amazement. The Mexicans pressed about with their hands outheld for tobacco, and Glanton and the colonel exchanged rudimentary civilities, and then Glanton pushed on through that importunate horde. They were of another nation, those riders, and all that land to the south out of which they'd originated, and whatever lands to the east toward which they were bound, were dead to him. and both the ground and any sojourners upon it remote and arguable of substance. This feeling communicated itself through the company before Glanton had moved entirely clear of them, and each man turned his horse, and each man followed, and not even the judge spoke to excuse himself from out of that encounter. They rode on into the darkness, and the moon-blanched waste lay before them cold and pale. And the moon sat in a ring overhead, and in that ring lay a mock moon with its own cold gray and nacre seas. They made camp on a low bench of land where walls of dry aggregate marked an old river course, and they struck up a fire about which they sat in silence, the eyes of the dog and of the idiot and certain other men glowing red as coals in their heads where they turned. The flames soared in the wind, and the embers paled and deepened and paled and deepened like the bloodbeat of some living thing eviscerate upon the ground before them. And they watched the fire, which does contain within it something of men themselves, inasmuch as they are less without it and are divided from their origins and are exiles. For each fire is all fires, the first fire, and the last ever to be. By and by the judge rose and moved away on some obscure mission. And after a while someone asked the ex-priest if it were true that at one time there had been two moons in the sky. And the ex-priest eyed the false moon above them and said that it may well have been so. But certainly the wise high god, in his dismay at the proliferation of lunacy on this earth, must have whetted a thumb and leaned down out of the abyss and pinched it, hissing, into extinction. And could he find some alter means by which the birds could mend their paths in the darkness, he might have done with this one, too. The question was then put as to whether there were on Mars or other planets in the void men or creatures like them. And at this the judge, who had returned to the fire and stood half naked and sweating, spoke, and said that there were not, and that there were no men anywhere in the universe save those upon the earth. All listened as he spoke, those who had turned to watch him and those who would not.
"The truth about the world," he said, "is that anything is possible. Had you not seen it all from birth and thereby bled it of its strangeness, it would appear to you for what it is, a hat trick in a medicine show, a fevered dream, a trance bepopulate with chimeras having neither analogue nor precedent. An itinerant carnival, a migratory tent show, whose ultimate destination after many a pitch in many a muddied field is unspeakable and calamitous beyond reckoning. The universe is no narrow thing, and the order within it is not constrained by any latitude in its conception to repeat what exists in one part in any other part. Even in this world, more things exist without our knowledge than with it. And the order in creation which you see is that which you have put there, like a string in a maze, so that you shall not lose your way. For existence has its own order, and that no man's mind can compass, that mind itself being but a fact among others."
Brown spat into the fire.
"That's some more of your craziness," he said.
The judge smiled. He placed the palms of his hands upon his chest and breathed the night air, and he stepped closer and squatted and held up one hand. He turned that hand, and there was a gold coin between his fingers.
"Where is the coin, Davy?" "I'll notify you where to put the coin."
The judge swung his hand, and the coin winked overhead in the firelight. It must have been fastened to some subtle lead, horsehair perhaps, for it circled the fire and returned to the judge, and he caught it in his hand and smiled.
"The arc of circling bodies is determined by the length of their tether," said the judge. "Moons, coins, men."
His hands moved as if he were pulling something from one fist in a series of elongations.
"Watch the coin, Davy," he said.
He flung it, and it cut an arc through the firelight, and was gone in the darkness beyond. They watched the night where it had vanished, and they watched the judge. And in their watching, some the one and some the other, they were a common witness.
The coin, did he? The coin, whispered the judge.
He sat erect and raised his hand and smiled around. The coin returned back out of the night and crossed the fire with a faint, high droning, and the judge's raised hand was empty, and then it held the coin. There was a light slap, and it held the coin. Even so, some claimed that he had thrown the coin away and palmed another like it, and made the sound with his tongue. For he was himself a cunning old Malabarista. And he said himself as he put the coin away what all men knew, that there are coins and false coins. In the morning some did walk over the ground where the coin had gone. But if any man found it, he kept it to himself. And with sunrise they were mounted and riding again. The cart with the idiot in his cage trundled along at the rear. And now Glanton's dog fell back to trot alongside, perhaps out of some custodial instinct such as children will evoke in animals. But Glanton called the dog to him, and when it didn't come, he dropped back along the little column and leaned down and quirted it viciously with his hobble rope and drove it out before him. They began to come upon chains and pack saddles, single trees, dead mules, wagons. Saddle trees eaten bare of their rawhide coverings, and weathered white as bone. A light chamfering of mice teeth along the edges of the wood. They rode through a region where iron will not rust nor tin tarnish. The ribbed frames of dead cattle under their patches of dried hide lay like the ruins of primitive boats upturned upon that shoreless void. And they passed lurid and austere the black and desiccated shapes of horses and mules that travelers had stood afoot. These parched beasts had died with their necks stretched in agony in the sand, and now upright and blind and lurching askew with scraps of blackened leather hanging from the fretwork of their ribs, they leaned with their long mouths howling after the endless tandem suns that passed above them. The riders rode on. They crossed a vast, dry lake with rows of dead volcanoes ranged beyond it like the works of enormous insects. To the south lay broken shapes of scoria in a lava bed as far as the eye could see. Under the hooves of the horses the alabaster sand shaped itself in whorls, strangely symmetric, like iron filings in a field, and these shapes flared and drew back again, resonating upon that harmonic ground and then turning to swirl away over the playa. As if the very sediment of things contained yet some residue of sentience. As if in the transit of those riders were a thing so profoundly terrible as to register even to the uttermost granulation of reality. On a rise at the western edge of the playa, they passed a crude wooden cross where Maricopas had crucified an Apache. The mummified corpse hung from the cross tree with its mouth gaped in a raw hole, a thing of leather and bone scoured by the pumice winds off the lake, and the pale tree of the ribs showing through the scraps of hide that hung from the breast. They rode on. The horses trudged sullenly the alien ground, and the round earth rolled beneath them, silently milling the greater void wherein they were contained. In the neuter austerity of that terrain, all phenomena were bequeathed a strange equality, and no one thing, nor spider, nor stone, nor blade of grass, could put forth claim to precedence. The very clarity of these articles belied their familiarity, for the eye predicates the whole on some feature or part, and here was nothing more luminous than another, and nothing more enshadowed, and in the optical democracy of such landscapes all preference is made whimsical, and a man and a rock become endowed with unguessed kinships. They grew gaunted and lank under the white suns of those days, and their hollow, burned-out eyes were like those of noctambulants surprised by day. Crouched under their hats they seemed fugitives on some grander scale, like beings for whom the sun hungered. Even the judge grew silent and speculative. He'd spoke of purging oneself of those things that lay claim to a man, but that body receiving his remarks counted themselves well done with any claims at all. They rode on, and the wind drove the fine gray dust before them, and they rode an army of gray beards, gray men, gray horses. The mountains to the north lay sunwise in corrugated folds, and the days were cool and the nights were cold. And they sat about the fire, each in his round of darkness, in that round of dark, while the idiot watched from his cage at the edge of the light. The judge cracked with the back of an axe the shin bone on an antelope, and the hot marrow dripped smoking on the stones. They watched him. The subject was war.
"The good book says that he that lives by the sword shall perish by the sword," said the black.
The judge smiled, his face shining with grease.
"What right man would have it any other way?" he said.
"The good book does indeed count war an evil," said Irving. "Yet there's many a bloody tale of war inside it."
"It makes no difference what men think of war," said the judge. "War endures. As well ask men what they think of stone. War was always here. Before man was, war waited for him. The ultimate trade awaiting its ultimate practitioner. That is the way it was and will be. That way and not some other way."
He turned to Brown, from whom he'd heard some whispered slur or demur.
"Ah, Davy," he said. "It's your own trade we honor here. Why not rather take a small bow? Let each acknowledge each."
"My trade?"
"Certainly. What is my trade?" "War. War is your trade, is it not?"
"And it ain't yours?"
"Mine too, very much so."
"What about all them notebooks and bones and stuff?"
"All other trades are contained in that of war."
"Is that why war endures?"
"No. It endures because young men love it, and old men love it in them. Those that fought, those that did not."
"That's your notion."
The judge smiled.
"Men are born for games, nothing else. Every child knows that play is nobler than work. He knows, too, that the worth or merit of a game is not inherent in the game itself, but rather in the value of that which is put at hazard. Games of chance require a wager to have meaning at all. Games of sport involve the skill and strength of the opponents, and the humiliation of defeat and the pride of victory are in themselves sufficient stake, because they inhere in the worth of the principles and define them. But trial of chance or trial of worth, all games aspire to the condition of war. For here, that which is wagered swallows up game, player, all. Suppose two men at cards with nothing to wager save their lives. Who has not heard such a tale? A turn of the card. The whole universe for such a player has labored clanking to this moment, which will tell if he is to die at that man's hand or that man at his. What more certain validation of a man's worth could there be? This enhancement of the game to its ultimate state admits no argument concerning the notion of fate. The selection of one man over another is a preference absolute and irrevocable. And it is a dull man indeed who could reckon so profound a decision without agency or significance either one. In such games as have for their stake the annihilation of the defeated, the decisions are quite clear. This man, holding this particular arrangement of cards in his hand, is thereby removed from existence. This is the nature of war, whose stake is at once the game and the authority and the justification. Seen so, war is the truest form of divination. It is the testing of one's will and the will of another within that larger will, which because it binds them is therefore forced to select. War is the ultimate game, because war is at last a forcing of the unity of existence. War
is God.
Brown studied the judge.
You're crazy, Holden. Crazy at last.
The judge smiled.
Might does not make right, said Irving. The man that wins in some combat is not vindicated morally.
Moral law is an invention of mankind for the disenfranchisement of the powerful in favor of the weak. Historical law subverts it at every turn. A moral view can never be proven right or wrong by any ultimate test. A man falling dead in a duel is not thought thereby to be proven in error as to his views. His very involvement in such a trial gives evidence of a new and broader view. The willingness of the principals to forego further argument as the triviality which it in fact is, and to petition directly the chambers of the historical absolute, clearly indicates of how little moment are the opinions, and of what great moment the divergences thereof. For the argument is indeed trivial, but not so the separate wills thereby made manifest. Man's vanity may well approach the infinite in capacity, but his knowledge remains imperfect, and however much he comes to value his judgments, ultimately he must submit them before a higher court. Here there can be no special pleading. Here are considerations of equity and rectitude and moral right rendered void and without warrant. And here are the views of the litigants despised. Decisions of life and death, of what shall be and what shall not, beggar all questions of right. In elections of these magnitudes are all lesser ones subsumed, moral, spiritual, natural. The judge searched out the circle for disputants.
"But what says the priest?" he said.
Tobin looked up.
"The priest does not say."
"The priest does not say," said the judge. "Nihil dicit." "But the priest has said. For the priest has put by the robes of his craft and taken up the tools of that higher calling which all men honor. The priest also would be no God-server, but a God himself."
Tobin shook his head.
"You've a blasphemous tongue, Holden. And in truth, I was never a priest, but only a novitiate to the order."
"Journeyman priest or apprentice priest," said the judge. "Men of God and men of war have strange affinities."
"I'll not second-say you in your notions," said Tobin. "Don't ask it."
"Ah, priest," said the judge, "what could I ask of you that you've not already given?"
On the day following, they crossed the Malpais afoot, leading the horses upon a lake bed of lava, all cracked and reddish-black, like a pan of dried blood, threading those badlands of dark amber glass like the remnants of some dim legion scrabbling up out of a land accursed, shouldering the little cart over the rifts and ledges, the idiot clinging to the bars and calling hoarsely after the sun, like some queer, unruly god abducted from a race of degenerates. They crossed a cinderland of caked slurry and volcanic ash, imponderable as the burned-out floor of hell. And they climbed up through a low range of barren granite hills to a stark promontory, where the judge, triangulating from known points of landscape, reckoned anew their course. A gravel flat stretched away to the horizon. Far to the south beyond the black volcanic hills lay a lone albino ridge, sand or gypsum, like the back of some pale sea beast surfaced among the dark archipelagos. They went on. In a day's ride they reached the stone tanks and the water they sought. And they drank and baled water down from the higher tanks to the dry ones below for the horses. At all desert watering places there are bones, but the judge that evening carried to the fire one such as none there had ever seen before, a great femur from some beast long extinct that he'd found weathered out of a bluff, and that he now sat measuring with the tailor's tape he carried and sketching into his log. All in that company had heard the judge on paleontology, save for the new recruits, and they sat watching and putting to him such queries as they could conceive of. He answered them with care, amplifying their own questions for them, as if they might be apprentice scholars. They nodded dully, and reached to touch that pillar of stained and petrified bone, perhaps to sense with their fingers the temporal immensities of which the judge spoke. The keeper led the imbecile down from its cage and tethered it by the fire with a braided horsehair rope that it could not chew through, and it stood leaning in its collar with its hands outheld as if it yearned for the flames. Glanton's dog rose and sat watching it, and the idiot swayed and drooled with its dull eyes falsely brightened by the fire. The judge had been holding the femur upright in order to better illustrate its analogies to the prevalent bones of the country about, and he let it fall in the sand and closed his book.
"There is no mystery to it," he said.
The recruits blinked dully.
"Your heart's desire is to be told some mystery. The mystery is that there is no mystery."
He rose and moved away into the darkness beyond the fire.
"Aye,"
said the ex-priest, watching, his pipe cold in his teeth.
"And no mystery. As if he were no mystery himself, the bloody old hoodwinker."
3 days later, they reached the Colorado. They stood at the edge of the river watching the roiled and clay-colored waters coming down in a flat and steady seething out of the desert. Two cranes rose from the shore and flapped away, and the horses and mules led down the bank ventured uncertainly into the eddying shoals and stood drinking and looking up with their muzzles dripping at the passing current and the shore beyond. Upriver they encountered in camp the remnants of a wagon train laid waste by cholera. The survivors moved among their noonday cookfires or stared hollowly at the ragged dragoons riding up out of the willows. Their chattels were scattered about over the sand, and the wretched estates of the deceased stood separate to be parceled out among them. There were in the camp a number of Yuma Indians. The men wore their hair hacked to length with knives, or plastered up in wigs of mud, and they shambled about with heavy clubs dangling in their hands. Both they and the women were tattooed of face, and the women were naked save for skirts of willow bark woven into string. And many of them were lovely, and many more bore the marks of syphilis. Glanton moved through this balesome depot with his dog at heel and his rifle in his hand. The Yumas were swimming the few sorry mules left of the party across the river, and he stood on the bank and watched them. Downriver they'd drowned one of the animals and towed it ashore to be butchered. An old man in a shakto coat and a long beard sat with his boots at his side and his feet in the river.
"Where's your all's horses?" said Glanton.
"We ate them."
Glanton studied the river.
"How do you aim to cross?"
"On the ferry."
He looked cross river to where the old man gestured.
"What does he get to cross ye?" he said.
"Dollar ahead."
Glanton turned and studied the pilgrims on the beach. The dog was drinking from the river, and he said something to it, and it came up and sat by his knee. The ferry boat put out from the far bank and crossed to a landing upstream, where there was a dead man built of drift logs. The boat was contrived from a pair of old wagon boxes fitted together and caulked with pitch. A group of people had shouldered up their dunnage and stood waiting. Glanton turned and went up the bank to get his horse. The ferryman was a doctor from New York State named Lincoln. He was supervising the loading, the travelers stepping aboard and squatting along the rails of the scow with their parcels and looking out uncertainly at the broad water. A half-mastiff dog sat on the back watching. At Glanton's approach it stood, bristling. The doctor turned and shaded his eyes with his hand, and Glanton introduced himself. They shook hands.
"A pleasure, Captain Glanton. I'm at your service."
Glanton nodded. The doctor gave instructions to the two men working for him, and he and Glanton walked out along the downriver path, Glanton leading the horse and the doctor's dog following some 10 paces behind. Glanton's party was camped on a bench of sand partially shaded by river willows. As he and the doctor approached, the idiot rose in his cage and seized the bars and commenced hooting as if he'd warned the doctor back. The doctor went wide of the thing, glancing at his host. But Glanton's lieutenants had come forward, and soon the doctor and the judge were deep in discourse, to the exclusion of anyone else. In the evening, Glanton and the judge and a detail of 5 men rode downriver into the Yuma encampment. They rode through a pale wood of willow and sycamore flaked with clay from the high water. And they rode past old acequias and small winter fields where the dry husks of corn rattled lightly in the wind. And they crossed the river at the Algodones Ford. When the dogs announced them, the sun was already down and the western land red and smoking. And they rode single file in cameo, detailed by the whiny light, with their dark sides to the river. Cook fires from the camp smoldered among the trees, and a delegation of mounted savages rode out to meet them. They halted and sat their horses. The party approaching were clad in such fool's regalia, and withal bore themselves with such aplomb, that the paler riders were hard put to keep their composure. The leader was a man named Caballo en Pelo. And this old mogul wore a belted wool overcoat that would have served a far colder climate, and beneath it a woman's blouse of embroidered silk, and a pair of pantaloons of gray cassinet. He was small and wiry, and he had lost an eye to the Maricopas, and he presented the Americans with a strange priapic leer that may have at one time been a smile. At his right rode a lesser chieftain named Pascual, in a frogged coat out at the elbows, and he wore in his nose a bone hung with small pendants. The third man was Pablo, and he was clad in a scarlet coat with tarnished braiding and tarnished epaulets of silver wire. He was barefooted and bare of leg, and he wore on his face a pair of round green goggles. In this attire they arranged themselves before the Americans and nodded austerely. Brown spat on the ground in disgust, and Glanton shook his head. "Ain't you a crazy-looking bunch of niggers?" he said. Only the judge seemed to weigh them up at all, and he was sober in the doing, judging, as perhaps he did, that things are seldom what they seem. "Buenos tardes," he said. The mogul tossed his chin. A small gesture darkened with a certain ambiguity. "Buenas tardes," he said. "De donde viene?" Chapter 18. The Return to Camp. The Idiot Delivered. Sarah Borginis. A Confrontation. Bathed in the River. The Tumbril Burned. James Robert in camp. Another baptism. Judge and fool. When they rode out of the Yuma camp, it was in the dark of early morning. Cancer, Virgo, Leo raced the ecliptic down the southern night, and to the north the constellation of Cassiopeia burned like a witch's signature on the black face of the firmament. In the night-long parley, they'd come to terms with the Yumas in conspiring to seize the ferry. They rowed upriver among the flood-stained trees, talking quietly among themselves, like men returning late from a social, from a wedding, or a death. By daylight, the women at the crossing had discovered the idiot in his cage. They gathered about him, apparently unappalled by the nakedness and filth. They crooned to him, and they consulted among themselves, and a woman named Sarah Borginis led them to seek out the brother. She was a huge woman with a great red face, and she read him riot. "What's your name, anyways?" she said.
"Cloyce Bell, ma'am."
"What's his?"
"His name's James Robert, but they don't anybody call him it."
"If your mother was to see him, what do you reckon she'd say?"
I don't know. She's dead.
Ain't you ashamed?
No, ma'am.
Don't you sass me.
I'm not trying to. You want him, just take him. I'll give him to you. I can't do any more than what I've done.
Damn if you ain't a sorry specimen.
She turned to the other women.
You all help me. We need to bathe him and get some clothes on him. Somebody run, get some